first wave earlier this year. Authorities are blaming the soaring infection rates on a new, more transmissible variant of the virus, first identified in southeast England. Dr. Katie Sanderson of the Doctors Association has warned that the strain on hospitals is only going to get worse.
The volume of sick patients coming in with coronavirus is verging on unmanageable just in terms of ambulance capacity, A&E capacity and bed capacity. We haven't seen the patients who had coronavirus infections that they've contracted over Christmas yet because they're probably not sick enough to come to hospital yet.
Ambulances with infected patients have been forced to wait outside hospitals as capacity is overstretched. Many more infected individuals are forced to wait at home as ambulances are unable to meet the demands on the system.
This is something that we've just never experienced before. Control room staff are having to make incredibly difficult decisions to decide who gets an ambulance and in what order, quite often with huge numbers of people waiting for ambulances and they have nobody left to send.
A growing number of National Health Service staff are also off work because they are self-isolating or have become sick with the virus. Officials are now considering tightening coronavirus restrictions, with some suggesting a total nationwide lockdown to halt the spread of the new strain. Britain has recorded more than 71,000 confirmed coronavirus deaths, although some question the accuracy of the numbers when compared to mortality rates from previous years before the pandemic. According to the Office of National Statistics, the spike in fatalities for this year remains significantly higher than the government's official record of COVID fatalities.
This year will forever be remembered for the spread of COVID-19, but another, arguably more dangerous disease has spread rapidly too. Hate. More specifically, hate against Muslims. Some of the most obvious examples can be seen in France, with the French President Emmanuel Macron pushing through anti-Islam legislation to prevent so-called Islamic separatism. In a later speech, the President condemned Islam as a religion in crisis, which radicalizes citizens.
Mais je demande à tout citoyen, quelle que soit sa religion.
And there is, in this radical Islam, since this is what the issue is, let's take it on board and let's name it. There is a will, a demand, an organized method to go against the laws of the Republic and create a parallel order based on the other values. Developing a separatist society first off with the goal of ultimately taking total control, and that's what they are doing. Gradually, by rejecting the freedom of expression and freedom of thought.
Tensions in France additionally increased when the state publicly began defending insulting caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The row spilled over into violence with attacks against journalists on the 25th of September, a teacher beheaded by a lone wolf takfiri on the 16th of October, and then on the 18th, two Muslim women wearing hijab were viciously stabbed by attackers screaming, "You dirty Arabs." Outside of France, things aren't much better, with numerous incidents of far-right Quran-burning protests occurring across Scandinavia. Between November 2019 and October 2020, at least four notorious Quran desecration rallies have been allowed, despite the fact that these protests offend millions. The Norwegian Prime Minister even publicly defended Islamophobes' rights to desecrate this holy book back in August. Then there is the Islamophobic ban on the Muslim niqab, a policy enforced by many countries, despite the fact that covering your face has been proven to save lives. Austria has also jumped on the bandwagon, punishing all Muslims for the acts of a small minority of criminals, introducing new laws intended to gag Muslims' freedom of speech.
In the fight against political Islam, the ideological basis behind it, we are going to create a criminal offence called political Islam, in order to be able to move against those who aren't terrorists, but are preparing the ground for it.
Across the English Channel, a new conspiracy has been widely circulating, claiming that Muslims are somehow responsible for spreading the coronavirus. These ideas are not supported by any facts. However, the belief was so widespread it had to be debunked by a government fact-checker website. These are just a few examples, but studies suggest that Islamophobia is present at nearly all levels of society. vaccines are being produced to stop COVID-19, but what is being done to defeat racism against Muslims?
Protest in Pakistan against Israel over its unending atrocities in occupied Palestine has not been so unusual. People in Pakistan have traditionally supported Palestinians in their struggle against Israel since 1948, when Israel killed and expelled Palestinians in a mass number and occupied their land. Many here rally behind leaders beyond Pakistan's borders over their support for Palestinians. One such leader is Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, a top Iranian commander who resisted against Israel and backed Palestinians at a time when many Arab rulers not only abandoned Palestinians but also collaborated with Israel to suppress them. That is why many took to the streets in Pakistan after a U.S. drone assassinated General Soleimani in Iraq 1 year ago. Being victims of so-called war on terror, Pakistanis view the U.S. and its allies in a negative shade. Anti-U.S. and anti-Israel sentiments have been high in Pakistan for decades. So are some of the Arab rulers who have been under fire for normalizing their ties with Israel at the expense of the sufferings of the Palestinian people. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
After dozens of civilians, including Ghadi's government officials, were killed and injured in the attack on Aden Airport, the deputy head of the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, Hani bin Barak, accused Qatar and Turkey of being behind it, ruling out that Sana'a was involved in it.
It's clear who's behind this latest attack in Aden Airport is the one who benefit the most from this attack, and is United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates and its forces in Aden, because United Arab Emirates doesn't want to be there a government which can actually express the term Yemen, or which can actually be in Aden. That's why United Arab Emirates, they want south of Yemen to be divided, all Yemen to be divided, so the United Arab Emirates can control Bab al-Mandab and the Bab al-Mandab Strait, and as well control Socotra Island. And
videos that went viral on social media showed that the missiles were launched from inside the Green City in Aden, which made observers accuse the SDC of seeking to push back Hadi's government to Riyadh hotels and fail the Riyadh agreement. The deputy head of SDC had preempted the arrival of the new Hadi government with a campaign to raise the flags of South Yemen in private and public facilities, including Aden International Airport, and he also warned members of the Hadi government not to talk about Yemeni unity, which confirms the continuing tension between the two parties to the conflict in southern Yemen.
There is no place for Hadi and his government in Aden. This is the message that the attack on the airport carried, meaning that Aden will continue to suffer under the rule of the militias of the UAE-backed STC. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
This is the first ever Iranian-made coronavirus vaccine that has made its way to human trials. It's called COVID-1. Produced by Iranian biotech firm Shifa Farm, the vaccine was tested on 3 volunteers during a ceremony attended by Iran's health officials.
Today is a very promising day for all Iranians. Today we reap the strenuous efforts of our experts and researchers who work tirelessly to produce this vaccine. We are already setting up the needed infrastructure for the mass production of this vaccine to kick off its production at a large scale as soon as it clears all of the human trials.
Some 60,000 people signed up to get the jab after a call for volunteers issued by the health ministry. Out of this number, 56 people were confirmed for the first stage of the human trials. The approved volunteers will receive 2 shots within 2 weeks. The results will be announced roughly a month after the second shot. The first person who received the vaccine was the daughter of this man, who was in charge of the project to develop a local vaccine. He says this was meant to prove to all Iranians that the local vaccine is safe.
I want to send this message that I care about the health of my people the same way as I care about my children. The second message is that I, as a leader of this project, I'm 100% certain about the effectiveness and the safety of this vaccine.
Iran is working on 7 other local vaccines, each using a different technology for immunization against the virus. But none has so far cleared animal trials. Coviran uses a coronavirus that is weakened or killed by chemicals, similar to how polio immunizations work. Leading Western vaccines like Pfizer use newer, less proven technologies to target the coronavirus's spike protein using RNA. Iranian experts say their vaccine has an edge over its rivals. Coviran does not need to be kept in ultra-low temperatures, an issue that Pfizer is grappling with.
This vaccine, they don't need any special refrigeration. In a normal refrigerator, we can do it. And you know that our primary health care in Iran is very, very good. And maybe a lot of other countries, they don't have our primary health care. In primary health care, we are able to vaccinate very soon most of the people.
Coviran will be tested on at least 10,000 volunteers before getting the approval of the health ministry to hit the market. Health officials expect that the process will take a few months. Until then, Iranian authorities need to import foreign-made vaccines to inoculate their citizens. But U.S. sanctions are a barrier. The embargoes do not directly target Iran's medical industry. But due to banking restrictions, the country cannot transfer money to any international medical firm which would sell its products to Iran.
Experts here say their concerns about the sanctions have acted as a catalyst that helped catapult them to the human trial phase ahead of the set deadline. Now as the Iranian vaccine is inching closer to the market, hopes are revived that Iranians will no longer have to worry about the American barriers that block their access to foreign vaccines. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
These days, Lebanon is hosting various events marking the first anniversary of the martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. This book reads, "The Man Who Vanquished America," will be out in bookstores on the martyrdom anniversary on January 3rd. The author tells Press TV he started writing after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020, and the main inspiration for him was the personality of the man who changed the region and even the world.
This man is the man, in terms of strategy, is the man of the century. The United States could not beat him. On the contrary, he defeated the United States in many posts, in many positions, in many places, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Syria, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Palestine. So he outsmarted them.
One of the main discernments of deep study of the assassination of General Soleimani was that the will of the resistance will be more adamant on removing the U.S. hegemonic presence from the region.
Achieved nothing. They killed the freedom in their mind when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. They killed justice in their mind and in their people when they killed Haj Qasem Soleimani. On the contrary, Haj Qasem Soleimani now is living in every person or a thinker who think that Haj Qasem Soleimani represents such slogans, freedom, justice, and liberty.
U.S. Army generals and strategists, as well as those who grieved him, agree that the commander of the Quds force brought the people of West Asia together and made the cause of fighting U.S. oppression a united struggle. Other virtual events to commemorate the memory of the Iranian commander were held by a group of activists in the form of Lebanese traditional storytelling. Through this art form, the writers tried to narrate to the people of Lebanon the story of Commander Qasem Soleimani and his significant role in thwarting U.S. plots.
The biggest shock was when the U.S. Army General Petraeus read a message which read, "I am Qasem Soleimani, the commander of Al Quds forces. I am the one who conducts the Iranian policies in Iraq, Afghanistan, Gaza, and the entire region. And the Iranian ambassador in Iran is a member of the Quds force."
Many in the region who knew General Qasem Soleimani or learned about him after his martyrdom say they have no doubt that his martyrdom and the deeds done during his lifetime will lead to a complete liberation of the region. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines across Europe began this weekend. Healthcare workers and the elderly are getting the jab first. EU leaders have negotiated contracts for more than 2 billion vaccine doses from various suppliers. The first 200 million are the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine.
It was important for me to get vaccinated in order to protect myself, to protect my family, and to be a part of the solution to stop the pandemic.
I felt honored to get the vaccine, and lucky, because I can finally feel more protected. What gives me relief is the prospect that, after such a difficult and challenging period, we will finally get to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
The EU had planned the rollout to begin in unison across the bloc Sunday, but Hungary, Germany and Slovakia couldn't wait and began vaccinating on Saturday. The Netherlands says it won't start vaccinating until January 8th. The start of the EU's vaccine rollout comes after a more infectious COVID-19 variant was detected in the UK, which led to dozens of countries closing their borders to UK citizens.
Only if countries are looking and testing effectively, will you be able to pick up variants and adjust strategies to cope. We must ensure that countries are not punished for transparently sharing new scientific findings.
The new variant has been detected in several EU countries as well, but vaccine developers say they expect their shots to work against COVID-19 mutations. More than 600,000 vulnerable people have already been vaccinated in the UK, which started administering the Pfizer jab 2.5 weeks ago. But ministers warn the country must double its vaccination target to 2 million a week in order to avoid a third wave.
I think it's an incredibly serious, incredibly dangerous moment. I think all of us always felt that January was going to become very hard and that we were heading into a very hard winter, and hospital leave was being cancelled and ITUs were being got ready. And yet, nevertheless, I feel like we weren't ready for something quite as severe as this feels, with the sheer level of caseload and the added effect of the variant virus building up our R number and making things so much harder than we expected.
The UK hopes to expand its vaccination programme with the rollout of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, which is expected on January 4th. There are now more COVID-19 patients in hospitals in England than there were during the peak of the first wave, and more than 71,000 Britons have died of the virus. Bianca Rahimi, London.
General Qasem Soleimani was a high-ranking Iranian military official whose popularity began to rise after he led the war on Daesh terrorists on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq. General Qasem Soleimani was the commander of Iran's Quds Force, the foreign arm of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. He was of great help to Syria as an advisor and organizer of Syrian troops when Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists launched a bloody assault on Syria in 2011. He also played a key role in creating Iraq's Popular Mobilization Unit, also known as Hashd al-Shaabi, in 2014, when Daesh declared its caliphate in Iraq and overran several provinces there. Hashd al-Shaabi later managed to defeat Daesh and drive the terrorist group out of Iraq. These victories for Syrian and Iraqi forces further increased General Soleimani's popularity among the Iraqis, Syrians, and Iranians. When General Soleimani declared the end of the Daesh Caliphate in 2018, the United States, which called itself the savior of the Iraqi and Syrian people, described him as its arch enemy and an obstacle to peace in the Middle East. The U.S. imposed sanctions on Soleimani. The Israeli regime also put Soleimani on its so-called terror list. In the year 2020, the assassination of General Soleimani and Hashd al-Shaabi's commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandis in a U.S. drone strike raises a key question. Was the United States really fighting Daesh? or as US President Donald Trump himself has said, was Daesh created by his predecessor Barack Obama? Perhaps now it would be easier to answer this question after the assassination of General Soleimani. What is clear is that the United States has killed a man who played the biggest role in both eliminating Daesh from the region and isolating Washington. Following this terrorist attack and the martyrdom of a group of people who had fought Daesh and other Takfiri terrorists round the clock, the question is, who really wants peace and stability in the region? And who is after igniting a war to plunder the Middle East?
In the limelight.
Donald Trump's fellow Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Friday, 1st of January 2021, took the atypical rebellious step of overriding his veto for the first time in his presidency. The Senate pushed through a bill on defense spending against Donald Trump's strong objections, with just 20 days left before Donald Trump leaves office. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Edward Helmore. The piece is titled, Senate Overrides Donald Trump's Veto of Defense Spending Bill. Stay with us for more of Edward Helmore's article. Donald Trump's fellow Republicans in the U.S. Senate on Friday, 1st of January 2021, took the atypical rebellious step of overriding his veto for the first time in his presidency. The Senate pushed through a bill on defense spending against Donald Trump's strong objections just 20 days before Trump leaves office. Meeting in a rare New Year's Day session, the Senate secured the two-thirds majority needed to override the veto with bipartisan support 2 days before a new Congress will be sworn in on Sunday. Eight previous vetoes of legislation have been upheld. Under the U.S. Constitution, the president has the power to veto a bill passed by Congress, but lawmakers can uphold the bill if two-thirds of both the House of Representatives and the Senate vote to override it. The Republican-led Senate, following the democratically controlled House of Representatives on Monday, passed the measure without Donald Trump's support, voting 81 to 13 on Friday afternoon. Overriding Donald Trump's veto marks a striking departure for GOP senators, who have largely stood by the president during his turbulent White House term. But Donald Trump's objections to the bill angered lawmakers, who had labored for months to put together a bipartisan bill and pride themselves on passing the military bill each year for 60 years, and voted to ignore his opposition to it. $740 billion National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, determines everything from military programs and construction projects to how to address geopolitical threats. Donald Trump refused to sign it into law because of his failure to repeal Section 230, a federal law that provides a legal liability shield for internet companies, and because it includes a provision stripping the names of Confederate generals from military bases. We've passed this legislation for 59 years in a row, and one way or another we're going to complete the 60th Annual National Defense Authorization Act, and pass it into law before this Congress concludes on Sunday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said. As votes were being counted, indicating Donald Trump had lost the battle, the president tweeted, touting a protest planned in Washington on Wednesday when the new Congress officially tallies the Electoral College votes certifying Democrat Joe Biden's presidential victory in November's election. Meanwhile, President Trump returned to Washington on Thursday, abruptly cutting short a holiday retreat to his private South Florida resort as the president's allies on Capitol Hill prepared to mount a last-ditch challenge to Joe Biden's election victory on 6th of January. The president had reportedly been in a stormy mood since his arrival at Mar-a-Lago, where he decamped days before Christmas and was originally expected to remain through to New Year's Eve celebrations. It was not clear what triggered President Trump's change of plans. He declined to answer questions upon boarding for his flight back to White House on Thursday morning, 31st of December. But hours before the White House announced that Donald Trump would spend New Year's Eve in Washington, the Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri announced that he would object to the Electoral College result when Congress meets on 6th of January to affirm Joe Biden as the winner of November's presidential election. Donald Trump had been goading his most loyal backers in Congress to stage a final intervention on the floor of the House to try to overturn the results of the election. The effort to keep Donald Trump in power is all but destined to fail, but it will test Republicans' loyalty to the president, who maintains a vice-like grip on their party, even after Americans voted to remove him from office after a single term. Many Senate Republicans had hoped to avoid such a showdown over the certification process, typically a formality. The move by Josh Hawley, a conservative freshman believed to have presidential ambitions, will force his colleagues to publicly affirm or oppose the election results. Donald Trump has refused to concede, spending his last holiday season as president fuming over his loss. On Twitter, the president continued to amplify conspiracy theories about voter fraud and lashed out at Republican officials who have refused his demands to overturn his loss in their states. On Wednesday, he called on the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, to resign, even though multiple recounts affirmed Joe Biden's narrow historic victory in Georgia. It is worth noting that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell effectively denied Donald Trump's demand that Congress increase the size of coronavirus relief checks to Americans from $600 to $2,000.
Africa Today.
Nigeria, a country facing widespread violence. On the fifth anniversary of the Zaria massacre, many Muslims are still struggling for their rights. The massacre took place in Zaria, Kaduna State, in 2015. After a brutal attack by the Nigerian army, at least 348 civilians were killed, that's according to official tally, and 347 bodies were secretly buried. Welcome to Africa Today. I'm your host, Mubarak Kenya. In this episode, we look at the massacre, asking whether those responsible have been held accountable after 5 years. Apart from that, we delve into Nigeria's quest to end police brutality as the country continues suffering from terror attacks by Takfiri terrorists. Stay tuned.
Zaria Massacre. those killed in Zawiya during the notable human rights violation in mid-December 2015 were mostly members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Top Shia cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki was arrested along with his wife Mualima Zina, and many are blaming Saudi Arabia for funding the massacre. The victims were unarmed protesters, and human rights organizations have asserted that the violent crackdown, which continued for 3 days, was carried out without any provocation.
A commission of inquiry inside Nigeria also called for prosecution of all those involved in the killings. Yet, years later, justice is yet to be served. Our first guest is Mr. Masoud Shajare, human rights campaigner at the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Mr. Shajare, welcome to our program. On the fifth anniversary of the massacre, how much do we know about what actually happened on that day?
Well, part of the truth have come out already, even in their own investigation, which was set up almost a year after the massacre. It was a number of things came up. One was the fact that, according to them, over 400 people were massacred, but we've got the actual figure is just under 1,000. And they also admitted that they have big mass graves, and many people have been buried in those mass graves.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, in the studio, we are also joined by Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, who will elaborate to us on the situation. Hello, Mr. Abdullahi, and welcome to our program. Now, for a start, can you tell us exactly what is the situation of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, who've been incarcerated now for almost, actually, 5 years?
Yes, the situation is still worse. That is, they were in a worse health condition because there is no appropriate medical attention given to them. And for the Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, recent analysis or recent investigation revealed that he has about 55 foreign body shrapnels, bullet shrapnels in his body.
Not removed yet, yeah?
Yes, none has been removed. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he complained of some pain from his head downwards. Mm-hmm. And it was said that they must be removed before he can have his health been improved.
Now, thank you, Mr. Abdullahi, for that elaboration. And stay tuned for more.
The details of the massacre of hundreds of men, women, and children by soldiers in Zawiya are gruesome. Some were injured and burned alive, and the bodies of those killed were left littered in the streets. The arrest and prosecution of the military officers involved in the crackdown is part of the movement's quest for justice, which is yet to materialize.
Let us not forget, 5 working days a week, Nigerian Islamic movement and its supporters come in the street in Abuja and other cities, every single working day. And they've been shot at, they have been gassed, they have been killed, they have been arrested, they have been tortured, but it hasn't stopped.
The Islamic movement of Nigeria has been a target of the Nigerian government's heavy-handed crackdown from the get-go. The members' peaceful protests are suppressed by military forces as the Nigerian government has banned them as terrorists and detained their leader.
I just hope that we will continue to protest until they let us have contact with them, not show us pictures or give statements in press conferences. They should let us see them. If they don't let us see them, then we don't know that if they're healthy or not. We just know what they tell us. So hopefully the protests are peaceful and that we're not attacking anybody. We're just peacefully protesting that we want to see them and we want to make sure that they're alive. And they're alive and they're getting treatment. And until they allow us to see them, we're not going to trust whatever is it that they say.
Back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. A court, a Nigerian court actually, in Kaduna, has ordered the release of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki, but the government is adamant on continuing to detain him. Is the judiciary really independent in Nigeria?
Well, we cannot say yes, because if they're independent, the order given must have been complied with. But it seems that they were not independent. And we have seen a lot of things where the court has given an order and it was not being complied by the
government.
Yes, it's ignored by the government. So we cannot say they are defendant, although we are expecting justice from them in the court.
Thank you. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria has demanded the freedom of their leader through protests staged across Nigeria, including protests in the capital, Abuja. Defying the ban, the Islamic movement is alive and resolute in its demand for the freedom of Sheikh Zakzaki. The Muslim leader is indeed an emblem of resistance against injustice in the Islamic world today.
I don't think the power of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, and indeed their commitment, could be destroyed by these tactics. If anything, Islamic movement in Nigeria is now more prominent. And indeed, many more people in Nigeria see them as a legitimate opposition against corruption, against this sort of dictatorship. And, they actually have become people have become more supportive towards them.
Thank you, Mr. Shajare, for that. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, many members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria are still missing. I mean, since the massacre in Zaria in 2015 and throughout the years. Now, what is their fate, actually? Do you know, is there any investigation going on? Are there efforts to, find them?
Well, in fact, we don't have any news, information about them, because we cannot investigate. Though we thought that, we are thinking that they were in some detention facilities in some army barracks, but we don't have categorically an information on that.
And is there a way you can follow up through government agencies?
No, there's none. There's none, but we hope later.
Thank you for that, and stay tuned for more.
In the fifth anniversary of the crimes, those who lost their loved ones are still far from witnessing justice. Zaria has remained an epicenter for the government attempt to disrupt the movement's religious practices. Even peaceful protests are met harshly and trigger massive crackdown. The loss of lives, meanwhile, has been a source of concern, not just for the victims' Muslim brothers across the world, but also human rights organizations. This is while there are reports that the Saudi monarchy has been behind the massive crackdown on the movement. In order to promote Wahhabi doctrine, Riyadh is known to fund Salafist initiatives across the Muslim world and beyond.
There was a WikiLeaks document that showed that the Saudi embassies were putting pressure on Nigeria to tackle the ever-growing popularity of the Islamic movement of Nigeria, but also the officials, including the MBS, the prince, have actually said that we have tackled Iran's influence in Africa and Nigeria. And it's very clear that they are involved, they are financing these massacres.
Now, back to the studio with our guest, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, a member of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, do you think that foreign entities or governments are involved, actually, in the persecution of members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria?
Yes, they were really involved, directly and indirectly.
Okay.
The first evidence of their involvement was that immediately after the carnage, there was some information that we had that from one newspaper, American Times, that the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia has said that they have reduced the influence of Iran in Nigeria by attacking the Islamic movement. This is one of the example of the involvement of foreign entities. Yes. And also, recently, there were some reports that there were some software that was sold to Nigerian government, whereby they can easily track the pulse of people.
From which company this software is? From which company?
I'm not very sure about
it. Or from which country or state?
Unfortunately, I cannot remember that.
Because there were reports that an Israeli company has sold some spy software to the Nigerian government.
Yes, exactly. It's the same report. It's the same report.
Yeah.
Okay. So another thing also is that there is congratulation made by the same person, that is the prince of the Saudi
Prince
Arabia.
Salman.
Yes, Prince Salman. He said that he's is congratulating the Nigerian government that they have made some war against terrorism by the time they attack the Islamic movement. So this and the many other examples were evidences that indicate that there were involvement of foreign entities. Another thing, again, is the silence of the main media. For example, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation. In fact, when something less than that happens, they normally broadcast it immediately. Yeah. But this one, they don't
broadcast it. A blackout.
Yes.
Yeah.
So this one. And another thing is that there are a lot of things that happen and they intervene. Yeah. For example, the bell of Sambo Dasuki, that is a security advisor to the Jonathan. They just intervene and he was released.
Yeah.
And this is an indication that their silence is an approval of what has been done to Islamic movement. So these are some of the examples.
Thanks for that. Now, the Islamic movement in Nigeria simply wants the government to do the right thing. The Nigerian government and the military target the Islamic movement, while senseless violence and insecurity caused by the likes of Boko Haram remain to be addressed.
A few years after, you could see by 2010-2011, when the bombings and the attacks started, you know, there was this, I would say, very slow reaction to understanding how deep a threat this was. And then you see by 2013-2014, the attack got really, really massive, and it blew on our faces when, you know, there was that Chibok incident when, you know, young girls were, over 200 girls were taken, you know, from school. So if you see why the government started building capacity, acquiring weapons, which they hadn't done for many years, and weapons that actually fit into the theater and the threat that they face, you could see that they started making gains.
Farmers are beheaded, schools are attacked, and bandits raid people's homes. The Islamic movement in Nigeria argues that the reason for the failure to address Takfiri militancy or terrorism is the government's dysfunctional system. The military forces appear to be only capable of suppressing peaceful dissent rather than taking on actual criminals. So are the protests effective?
Well, it's extremely effective. I mean, you give me another place around the world that's 5 years with all these brutality, still people come out, still stand up. People have, you know, given members of their family, not one or two.
Thank you for that, Mr. Masroor Chajare of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London. Now, back to you, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, Sheikh Zakzaki has been away, imprisoned for 5 years now. Now, how is the Islamic movement coping with his absence? Is it still continuing with its activities?
Yes, although it is disheartening, the loss of the leader of that kind. However, before he told us that we should continue with what we are doing.
Yeah.
And even before that, he has trained us that not only all things will come from him. We have to have our initiatives.
Yeah.
So all things, all the programs that we accustom, they are progressing. None has stopped.
Oh,
therefore, we cope with that.
So there's no vacuum.
No, there's no vacuum.
Okay, now, as the Islamic movement in Nigeria, are you collaborating with other human rights organizations and civil rights groups in demanding or in pressurizing the Nigerian government to release Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife, and also to probe other incidents of persecution of members of the movement?
Yes, there are a lot. All well-meaning people must be sided with the oppressed.
Yeah.
So we have some civil organizations such as the organization headed by Deji Adeyanju.
Okay.
That is called Nigerian Concern Groups.
Very
That's
good.
Nigerian Concern Group is really, we are really working together.
Yeah.
They are involved in our activities of Free Zakzaki campaign.
Yeah.
And most of them were Christians. Most of them are Christian,
That's
but today we are together.
Yeah.
We are together. And there were individuals also that were normally, you know, they were against the operation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are a lot.
Well, thank you for that, Mr. Hussein Abdullahi, for joining us today to discuss about the state of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and the continued illegal incarceration of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. We are looking forward to his release, and that the calls for Free Zakzaki will be listened by the Nigerian government, and he will be released and go back to serve the people and actually the whole society in Nigeria, because I believe he was serving the whole society in Nigeria regardless of religion or sect. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you for watching.
End SARS protests.
Youths in Nigeria are fed up with the way police forces treat innocent people. The social movement against police brutality and extortion initially called for the disbanding of the Special Robbery Squad, SARS. The notorious unit of the Nigerian police has a long record of abuses. But instead of addressing crimes like armed robbery and kidnappings, the forces resorted to human rights violations, extrajudicial killings, sexual harassment of women, and brutalizing young people.
A couple of Nigerian youths are in the hospital currently in pains, suffering from results of stray bullets shot directly to unarmed protesters.
The bad record by these Nigerian police units triggered peaceful protests in 2017 that continue to this day, although the government has resorted to a myriad of tactics to derail the movement. But what are the movement's demands, and are they within reach? We invited author and journalist Eric Welberg to share his view. Mr. Welberg, what's your take?
The primary demand is to release all the protesters that have been jailed, and also they want justice. They want compensation for those that were harmed and injured and killed, some of them during protests. They also want an investigation. They asked, they demanded a panel that would investigate the police actions, police brutality. And interestingly enough, they also asked for an increase in police salaries with the idea to reduce their reliance on bribery and to also make them more accountable for their actions.
SARS has been known for regularly detaining young male Nigerians illegally and extorting money from their relatives. Public outcry returned to social media when video showing a SARS police officer shooting a young Nigerian in front of a hotel went viral in October 2020. The forces have also been accused of widespread torture, mock executions, and other forms of physical and mental abuses. The reform and reorganization of SARS by the government has not only failed to bring an end to the demonstrations, but also infuriated activists across the country, yielding a new phase of the movement.
I think that they have a good possibility of reform, because it's they're strong. They've got 100 years of tradition. The first big demonstrations of Nigerian women were in 1929, and it was against colonial attempts to squeeze market, women, of course, dominating the market in Nigeria, and the British colonial government tried to siphon off more money from them.
Protests that swept the country in October against police brutality appear to be coming back. Among the protesters' top demands are the release of all those arrested in the peaceful protests. They are also seeking justice and compensation for all those who lost their lives due to police brutality.
Well, this protest against police brutality, the big place where that's happening is in the United States, but also in Britain, in Europe, in France, there are a lot of protests of police brutality. So I think there is a general groundswell of anger, and these women have really pushed to the forefront in protesting police brutality in Nigeria. So that's a good sign, but they're very angry. They had the same promises in 2017 and 2018, so nothing really seemed to have happened. So I don't know if this time they will succeed.
Now, the movement that started as an effort to reform police now looks like the beginning of a youth awakening in Nigeria. Women are also playing a key role in the movement as diverse communities unite behind one goal to form the backbone of the NSAS protests.
We're here because we believe in what we're fighting for. We're firm to it. And, you know, if you listen to our national anthem and our national pledge, we are here to defend our unity.
We are fighting for the truth. We are fighting for the labor of our heroes' past. We don't want it to be in vain.
I prefer to die well for my children to have a better tomorrow. The truth is it.
There have been lots of graphic footage showing police and army officers shooting and abusing protesters. The activists are now wary of bad governance involving vows to investigate killings while simultaneously discrediting reports of abuses. There are meanwhile efforts underway to organize a network of lawyers to provide free legal support to protesters and victims of police abuses across the country. That's the end of today's program. We hope to see Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife out of prison to join their family, friends, and companions. And we wish peace and prosperity for the people of Nigeria. Goodbye for now, and God bless you all.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Great hero, general of hearts. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Former commander of IRGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, Deputy Commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their eight companions attained martyrdom on January 3, 2020, in a terrorist attack near Baghdad's airport with a direct order of the outgoing criminal U.S. President Donald Trump. This year, the anniversary of the event falls on January 2nd due to the leap year of 2020. 1 year has passed since that tragic day, but the memory of Martyr Soleimani's valor and his luminous face will never be forgotten. The families of martyrs who lost their life for defending the holy shrines of Ahlul Bayt will never forget his lovely face and kind hands that would cherish the children of martyrs like a loving father. He was the manifestation of Ayah 29 of Surah Fath of the Noble Quran, which says that the Prophet of Islam and his companions are hard against the faithless and merciful among themselves. The event of 13th of the Iranian month of Dey, that is January 3rd, 2020, revealed a personality who had ruled over hearts. The assassination of Qasem Soleimani was a great strategic mistake for the Americans. This dastardly act of terror caused the people of the world know the personality of the icon of fight against terrorism. It breathed new spirit in the body of the front of resistance and freedom-seeking nations in the region and beyond. This is the impact of martyr and martyrdom, which the global arrogance is unable to understand. Self-sacrifice is justifiable only in a religion that thinks beyond the transient life of this world. Only those who believe in salvation and eternal bliss in the hereafter can march in this path. According to the Islamic culture, a martyr is a person who moves in the way of truth and virtue. He burns to give light and comfort to others. Martyrdom is sacred because it is the conscious sacrifice of one's whole being for a sacred goal. Martyrs are the source of a spiritual life of a society because they march toward ideals and hope, and they only seek the victory of truth. Martyr Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani wrote for one of his daughters, "Dear Fatima, I am writing a few pages for you because I know that you love me sacredly. I don't know why I am writing these words, but I feel that I need someone to unfold my heart with in this loneliness of my life. My bloody death, my dearest, my beautiful, where are you? I am eager to meet you. When the blast of your kiss annihilates my entire being, evaporates it and burns it, how much I love this moment. How beautiful this scene is. How much I love this moment. Losing your life in the way of love is very beautiful. My God, I have striven for this moment for 30 years. I have struggled with all rivals of love for this moment. I have sustained injuries. I have sent mediators. How beautiful this scene is. How much I love this moment." What Martyr Soleimani did caused even his enemies to laud him for his bravery, insight, management, acumen, military prowess, and recognition of enemy. In the battlefront, he would design and execute the best attacks. He was a commander who would not get tired. With his cleverness, he used to command one of the most powerful divisions during the eight-year imposed war. It was the division Sar Allah 41 of Kerman. His headquarters was the forefront and not concrete buildings of in the back of the battlefront. He used to go first and say to his forces, "Come," rather seating and ordering them go. Thus, he would first put his life at risk and then call on his forces to do the same. Another characteristic of the General of Hearts was that he was a moderate person and would not go to extremes. As for political issues, he used to give advice to various factions. He was not after power at all, although he had the second position in the hearts of people after the supreme leader. Yes, he was the second beloved man after the leader, not just in Iran, but among all Islamic nations who seek freedom and fight against the global arrogance and Zionism. Martyr Soleimani was very popular and led a simple life. His view on the young generation was that a loving father